Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us David Drebin. David, glad you could join us today.
My cleaning lady just arrived. Give me a second. Sorry.
Hold on. We ought to just continue on and leave that in.
Right? Awesome, man. Give me one second. Carla, yeah. I'm just doing a podcast. So good to see you. Come on in. That's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, there she is. Tell her to wave in the background.
That's Carla. Yes.
Hey.
That's awesome.
So, Carla, whenever she's done, can you send her over to our studio and clean it? Because we have not vacuumed the floor, cleaned our table, anything since we've been going over a year. So I think we're a little overdue. Yeah.
Carla, you got to go to Dallas, Fort Worth. Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
there we go. Well, David, great you could join us today, man.
Thank you.
Great. Now, in several languages, there's a common phrase that a picture is worth a thousand words. Now, that can be interpreted in a number of ways. Like, if you're a fifth grader, a thousand words is a lot, because if they ask you to write a thousand word essay on rocks, you start to realize that, yeah, a thousand words is quite a lot. But I think what that original saying means is that, you know, a photograph can say so much, you actually run out of words, that, you know, perhaps it communicates things you can't say in words. And I guess the beauty of photography compared to other mediums such as movies and books is it allows so much room for personal interpretation of a visual image that it's probably the last pure art form left where somebody's not telling you what to think and not see, what not to see in a picture.
Sorry, you want to hear my response to that?
Yeah. Sorry, that wasn't really a question. It was just a statement.
I mean, I think it's kind of like a metaphor where, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. It's just basically saying that when you look at an image, you can imagine many things that are happening, right?
Yeah.
It's just kind of a metaphor to life. It's not literally like 1, 2, 3, 4 to a thousand words. It's you know, just like when you read words, you imagine pictures, and when you look at pictures, you imagine words.
Yeah, makes sense. So, David, can you tell everybody just kind of a little bit about yourself? Of course, you know, we're going to be talking about photography and you're a photographer, but just a little bit of your background, what got you into photography, all that good stuff.
So I'm originally from Toronto, Canada, and I found photography in my early 20s. And I realized that I wanted to show my creativity and talent to the world. So I moved to New York in 1994. I went to Parsons School of Design. And basically, I don't see myself as an artist or a photographer. I see myself as a creator of luxurious products that I showcase in the finest galleries all over the world. I've never led with, like, I'm an artist, I'm a photographer. Everyone thinks they're a photographer. So I just have a unique perspective on the world, and we all do, but I make a living creating and marketing and branding that perspective that I have. So I've made, you know, 8 books of my work with a top publisher in Germany. I've had over 100 solo exhibitions all over the world. I have major collectors all over the world, from Germany, Austria, Dubai, Turkey, Venezuela. Like, I've been doing this for a very long time, and I have an amazing collector base, and I love to make beautiful artwork, but I also really care about customer service from start to finish, from when the buyer collects the work and to when the gallery delivers the work. For me, it's all about an experience. So I'm in the experience business, I'm in the value business, and I'm in the art business.
Now, do you find yourself pretty critical of your work, or do you know instantly that's what you wanted to achieve? We're doing something, because some people, you know, like artists, you know, are almost critical to the point of suicide on their work. You know, they're not able to convey what they're thinking, feeling. But, you know, some people, it just clicks and they don't care as long as it conveys what they were feeling at that time and what they wanted to represent. They're okay. But are you pretty easy going on yourself in terms of your work?
Well, I'm a very harsh but realistic critic of myself. And I like to create emotionally charged works, but I have no emotional attachment to my work. I want other people to have an emotional attachment to the work that I create with an emotional bent to it. But when the work is done, after I study it and make sure it's ready to be released to the world in the same way that a chef releases a dish to the waiter, he's not emotional about the beautiful dish that he created. I study it. I don't release it until it's ready to go. And then I have no emotional attachment to the final image.
So walk us through a little bit about that process. And I'm sure it's a little bit different depending on the subject matter, the photograph or the piece of art or whatever, but maybe one that is short as far as time-wise is concerned, and maybe an example of something that took you forever before you just put your final seal of approval on that.
I always like to compare this to making a dish, or like a food. Some things like a souffle can take hours and hours and hours, and other things you can just whip up like scrambled eggs in 30 seconds. So some images take longer than others. Some I have to travel further for to create, but you never know until you're in it how long it's going to take. You just don't know. You just have to have the meal or the image in your mind that you want to create, and then you just make it happen until it's done. There's no timeline. Some are faster than others.
Right. Do you have problems where people misinterpret what you were trying to portray? And has it ever kind of annoyed you that what you thought was a pretty obvious message you were trying to give was completely taken the wrong way?
That's a great question. If I worried what people thought about me or thought about my work, I'd be in an insane asylum. So I have a belief in myself and a belief in my work, and I put it out there for the world to see. I make very limited edition works. And if I know it's great, I don't really think about if other people like it or not, because I like it. And I work from an internal position of acceptance as opposed to an external position of acceptance. When you live your life based on external validation, you will never be as validated as you expect to be. If you chase fame, you'll never be as famous as you want to be. These are quicksand. It's a quicksand way of thinking. I like to live in reality and not on quicksand.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that in the world right now, especially in like the entertainment industries or the arts industries. There's a lot of folks that say, well, let me go ahead and make something that is going to get a bunch of views or is going to get a bunch of likes or whatever. Let me follow that trend and find what everybody else is doing to get those likes, to get those views, to get those followers, to get all of that versus actually putting their heart and soul into it. And what I'm gathering from you then is you don't care if you get one like or a million likes on a photo on Instagram. If you put your heart and soul into it and you stand by it, all the rest of that's going to come, correct?
I don't live for likes and followers. I think that a lot of people do, but it's all about external validation. That's one of the big problems with the world right now is so many people live with, they don't get enough followers. They don't have enough likes, and someone else has more likes. Someone else has more followers. It just breeds insecurity and jealousy and envy. And I just don't really, I'm a very grounded person, and I'm a very grateful grounded person. So we all have limited time. I have extreme belief in myself. I always have, and I always will. And I don't worry if someone likes me or likes my work. I stay in my lane, and I'm very focused. Very.
Yeah, I think that to some extent, we've all been oversaturated with photographic images since the rise of camera phones. You know, before you'd maybe see one photo of a relative every 10 or 15 years when it, you know, went back to Polaroids and everything else. Whereas now it's like every time, you know, they have a bowel movement, it's on Facebook or Instagram. And, you know, to some extent, I think mediocrity has kind of crept in where you look at images which are supposed to be picturesque and stunning and saying something, but you've seen so many similar images, there's nothing that stands out. Is there a trick to taking photos which, if you took a photo, how would you make it say more than if we were taking that photo at that same scene? What type of technique would give it your ID as such?
The greatest trick is basically two words. Be yourself is the greatest trick of all. Most people, that's very tricky for them to be themselves. I just am myself. This is the way I think, and I use lighting to accentuate my photographic ideas. I use neon to accentuate my neon light installation ideas. I make sculptures, I make diamond dust prints. It's all a form of self-expression and the way that I think. It's a thought process.
Do you feel like there's too many people in the photography world? And before you answer that, I'm going to kind of give you the reason why I'm asking this. I remember when DSLR or DLSR cameras came out, it seemed like every stay-at-home mom changed their name on Facebook from Karen Smith to Karen Smith Photography, you know, and then wanted to run out and take all these pictures because now you could, for a few $100, buy a halfway decent camera by, like, our standards, probably not by your standards, and then go take better pictures than you could with the camera phone. So is there an oversaturation of photographers now because of something like that?
So one thing that I learned about 20 years ago is you don't see the word photography anywhere on my website. I never mention photography. I never mention photographer. I think the world is abundant and there's room for everybody, but I've always just been David Drebin. I've never been David Drebin Photography. I've never been David Drebin Photographer. I'm just David Drebin. And I think that when photographers add photography to their names, they become dime a dozen. If you're good, you don't need to write photography. You're just good.
Yeah.
That's it. Is LeBron James LeBron James basketball? No, he's LeBron James. Right? Is Wayne Gretzky Wayne Gretzky hockey? No, he's Wayne Gretzky. I'm just David Drebin.
Right.
There's no mention of photography anywhere. And in fact, I tell my galleries to not market or sell me as a photographer, but people are buying Drebins in the same way that they buy Chanel, in the same way that they buy Gucci, in the same way they buy Louis Vuitton or Ralph Lauren.
It's a brand.
I'm a brand. We're all brands. It's all about how you build your brand and who you align yourself with. I think there's room for everybody. But ultimately, the cream always rises to the top.
Now, have you found that you've gone through stages of experimenting with photography over the years from when you first started? Or have you tried to kind of like put all techniques into your work kind of simultaneously? Because I know certain photographers go through stages where they like, you know, emphasizing certain colors. Some of them switch to, you know, grayscale for a period of time. Some of them go to panoramic views. Do you just kind of completely close the doors to any type of influence other than how you're feeling when you want to represent a certain image?
I'm not a closed-minded person. I'm always open to new ideas. And I think I have a very wide range from panoramic landscapes all over the world to super close-up images of girls crushing diamonds on a rug. So for me, I really take pride in my range of art that I create and my artistic range and my photographic range. And lighting is incredibly important for my imagery as well. And people always ask me, so what kind of camera do you use? And I always say, this is my camera. My mind is my camera. The tool doesn't really matter as long as it's high enough resolution. The camera never matters. People think it's the camera. No, and it's not your eye. It's your imagination.
It's all
imagination.
Now, with panoramic photography, is that more difficult? Because obviously there's a lot more of the image, the landscape captured in that photo. And I understand the basics in terms of perhaps among a sea of blandness, you can make something stand out, maybe like an orchid in a turnip field or something. But when you have a very noisy panoramic photo, what type of techniques do you get to convey a message then? Because surely you're going to have a million different interpretations. And if you really are trying to communicate something through a panoramic photo, how do you go about doing that? Do you centralize on that, or what do you do?
I don't really think too much about the technique. It's almost like I was watching my friend cook breakfast the other day, and I'm not a good cook at all. And she just whipped up the spectacular meal. I was like, what did you do? She goes, it's just natural for me. It's just natural for me. Some people have like great, you can't learn how to be charismatic. You can't learn how to be funny. You can't learn how to have a personality. It's just natural for me. I don't ever think these thoughts. I never think technical. I just think, I want to go to Rio. I want to make this picture of Rio. I'm going to do it. I want to go to Jerusalem. I want to make this picture of Jerusalem. I'm going to do it. I want to make this photograph of New York. I'm going to do it. I don't analyze it. I feel it. I see it. I see it. And I feel it.
And all that is already entering your head, right? You're kind of presupposing that. Let's use Jerusalem, for instance, because you brought that up. You're picturing this piece of art that you want to make in the city of Jerusalem. You're seeing it kind of swimming around in your head, so to speak, before you actually make it, right? Am I on the right track there?
I just go make it happen. I really don't analyze it. I just, it's making the, okay. There's the band on the stage, which is making the art. And then there's the audience in the audience that you want to market the art to. I spend a lot of time focused on marketing the art to the audience, way more than actually creating the art, because creating the art is very easy for me. Putting the band together is very easy for me. But how do we get people to listen to the band? You guys are asking me about how did I build the band? But I'm actually really interested in how to create the audience for the band.
Right.
Playing the music with the band is easy.
Now, have you ever taken upon a kind of, I don't know, a grand vision to perhaps go somewhere like Jerusalem and take a sequence of, you know, photos which you really had in your mind, and you got there and it was disappointing in that you really couldn't represent with the camera what you imagined in your mind, that it really kind of failed to bring out what you wanted to communicate? Or have you always been able to really kind of hit the spot with that?
Before I make an image, I do a lot of research. I Google images of landscapes. And then I usually go to the city of my choice, and I go to the highest point imaginable, and I take the image for perspective. That's always my move, is go to the city and go to the highest point possible. You know, a lot of people ask me what my secrets are, and my answer is, I have no secrets. I will share everything with anyone, anytime. It's all about abundance. There's no competition except for your own reflection. I'm willing to share everything with everybody, the camera that I use, the hotels I stay in, the hotel rooms I've been in. I'm very free. And I think it's very important to have freedom.
Well, and I, in gathering kind of your line of thinking with this, I'm getting the idea that that's the easy stuff. Like you say, getting the band together, that's the easy stuff. You know, what kind of camera to go buy, that's the easy stuff, right? But being able to create something that is speaking to that audience and being able to figure out how to get that piece of art out to that audience is the real trick. And that's what you're really good at.
There's a great book. It's called The Philosophy of Andy Warhol. And Andy Warhol made art for 15 years, and then he marketed the art that he made in those 15 years for the next 15 years. So I still make a lot of art, but my work is limited edition, so I don't make as much as I used to, but I just want to show my work all over the world, and I do. And for me, it's about working with the right people, building the right teams, having the right manufacturers, having the right distribution. I mean, I love the art of photography, but it is my business also. So I'm running a big business of selling works through galleries all over the world. So I'm really in quality control mode, making sure that all my manufacturers have top-notch quality. That's very important. And I also make sure that my galleries treat me the right way, because a lot of relationships, you know, the galleries don't pay artists, and I make sure that if they don't pay me, they don't get the work. I don't care. I just won't release the work until I'm paid.
Yeah.
Now, and that can cause problems with galleries, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's like a gallery who's like what business will release something before they're paid? If they do, they're idiots, because then they constantly chase to get paid. So in any business, like you can't order something on Amazon and receive it and say, I'll pay you later. You got to pay for it before you receive it. So that's a really big thing for me, is to teach people how to treat me. We all teach people how to treat us. And so I'm running a business, and a lot of times galleries want the work. And I'm like, well, you can't get it until I'm paid. They're like, well, the collector hasn't paid us. I'm like, well, you're not going to release the work to the collector until you're paid. So I'm not releasing the work to you until I'm paid. Then sometimes massive fights break out, and I just won't release the work until I'm paid. So there's, you know, they say that when your passion becomes your occupation, you can lose your passion. And I will not let that happen to me. I will always have passion for creativity and for relationships. And if it wasn't for my passion for creativity, I never would have met the Wolf and the Shepherd, because we're on the call right now because of the appreciation for my range of artistic expression. And I think you guys are enjoying the conversation with me.
Right. And it, honestly, I pulled the little marker away from him because I was thinking about those examples you were giving. And the one that comes to mind is video games. So a lot of video game developers, publishers, whatever it's called, put out video games and they're incomplete. And then they ask people to buy DLC later, and their audience just basically throws stones at them constantly because of that. Where you're, like you say, in that quality control business, you don't want to mess with that after the fact. You want to make sure everything's good right up front. All the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed. So the quality control part is just as important as the creative process.
Very, unfortunately, about 99% of my time is spent in the business, in the marketing, in the quality control, in the managing of the distribution, in the managing of the manufacturers. I really miss making the art. I've made a lot of art. I made many books. I'm working on two more books. I have to carve out time for myself to make the art.
Right.
I carve out time. There are certain times of the year I make art more than others, actually. September is a big month for me. June's a big month for me. Those are my two main months to make art, September and June. I wish I was just out there every day with my camera. It doesn't work that way. It's very technical. Very technical.
Yeah. Now, did you embrace the switch from traditional photography to digital? Because I know a lot of people saw it as a, I don't know, that digital photography would only be something convenient for amateurs, and others thought it would perhaps pollute the purity of photography. But did you embrace it? Could you envisage all these things, that new world of photography really, which would open up to you, and things you could do which you were never able to do before? Were you looking forward to this new digital world of photography?
I embrace change. I'm not set in my ways, and I embrace growth. Always, in everything. We're always growing. We're not the same people we were yesterday and the day before. So I'm always adapting and pivoting to the best version of myself that I can be, the best products that I could use to express my vision. I just don't think, oh, film. People are often scared of change, and then they're left behind. I'm not scared of change. I love change. I love growth. I love winning.
Absolutely. And speaking of that change and growth, what do you see on the horizon as that next medium, let's call it, of your art, you know, that you want to get into, that's, I don't want to say less traditional, but at least that next future step that you're out there sniffing around saying, hey, this is cool. This has David Drebin written all over it. This is my next thing.
Well, it's a great question. I make many different art forms. I make photographs, diamond dust prints, light boxes, etchings on glass, sculptures, and neon installations. But I think the greatest art is the art of conversation. And so I'm on a lot of podcasts, and I love having conversation. I love to inspire the next generation. I love to inspire young people, old people, people in midlife who have a talent but not a confidence to pursue their true talent. And for me, there's nothing worse than wasted talent. So for me, the next great art is to be on more podcasts and to do more public speaking to inspire people. At the end of the day, my goal is to inspire other people to pursue their dreams and not waste their talent. That's my ultimate goal, far more than creating art And anything that's sort of ego-based, me, my art, no. I want to inspire other people to become great and not waste their own innate talent.
Right. Now, before we started recording and before your cleaner turned up, we were actually talking about the Oculus 2. And no free advertising for Meta there. You need to send us a check. But when you first put the Oculus on your head, did it send a million thoughts running through your brain about the future and how you could produce work for something like this, and how just as the shift went from analog to digital, this digital to now this three-dimensional immersive world, that it's going to bring about just as many, if not more, changes moving to this new technology than from where it's ever come before? And does that kind of blow your mind a little bit, and you're not even be able to, it's like a dog seeing 1,000 squirrels?
The Oculus blew my mind. When I first put that on, I just thought of a world of possibilities, because we created a virtual reality gallery, and like, you have to be sitting down to put the Oculus on. So you can go sailing in the Greek islands. You can go bungee jumping in New Zealand. You can go look at animals in Africa. It's like IMAX experience. It's unbelievable. The Oculus is the most mind-blowing, one of those mind-blowing things I've ever seen. It's like taking your imagination and having it come to life. I can see people living in 100 square foot apartments with Oculus on their faces, living in mansions that they created on the internet. So they even though they're physically in a 100 square foot apartment, they live in mansions with this thing on their face. It's absolutely insane. If you're willing to put it on your face and go there and really let your imagination go wild, it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole Ready Player One, Matrix kind of experience.
I love the Oculus. Yeah. I love change. I love it all.
Yeah, no, I love it. So you mentioned, you know, being on podcasts, right, and doing some public speaking. Why not start your own podcast? You thought about that?
I am actually. I'm actually starting a podcast. It's called Tap That Sass. And the motto is poke me, provoke me, and maybe change my mind. And I'm doing it with a friend of mine I've been friends with for over 30 years, who has no social media, and we've created a name for her named Shelly Shell. And what I've realized, and I think it's very important to be self-aware, is I'm a much better guest than I am a host. So I've been on many podcasts as a host, as a guest. Bit of a slip. But I realized that if I was a boxer, I'm a better counterpuncher than a puncher. So I prefer being a guest, and my partner, podcast partner, is a better host than me. So when I look at you two, I'm not sure who's the host and who's the guest. You guys are co-hosts, right? But for me, I'm a much better counterpuncher, and I'm a much better guest, and I picked the right partner to do this with. And so we're going to do it, but we're going to do it in a very different kind of way. We're going to have conversations. We're not going to call it a show. And then we're going to edit it down into like 8 to 10 minute clips of our conversations that we edit. So it's like an audio film.
Gotcha. And by the way, we were hoping you would help us figure out which one of us are the host, because we still haven't figured that out yet.
You're both very good co-hosts, very, very different energies, but it really works together. It works together. You guys work together beautifully. Beautiful. Well,
thank you very much.
I wish you wouldn't have said that. That's going to give him a big head, and then I'm going to have to deal with that the rest of the day.
How long have you guys been working together for?
About a little over a year.
Yeah, about 14 months, I think. It was having a podcast, I think, when you start off, even if you don't have a kind of goal at the end, I think you want to get somewhere where it kind of either remains fun or there's a focus on bringing in money. But right at the beginning, I think you start becoming a little bit too idealistic, because you start modeling yourselves on what you've heard before. And with us, we'd both listen to a lot of Joe Rogan. I mean, other podcasts as well, but that's the one podcast we kind of had in common. And it's hard to differentiate between, like, you know, there's now 2.74 million podcasts worldwide. How you actually get to be different, stand out, because obviously you have a name behind you. And so people are actually going to search for you because you're an expert in your field and you do fantastic work. But, you know, for people like us, we have to differentiate ourselves in a way that we're not following, I guess, the traditional popularity method, which is very question and answer driven.
Or very rehashing somebody else's formula.
Or very overproduced. So we just decided, you know what, it's better just to have a conversation with somebody and ask questions which come up naturally. I mean, we didn't write down any questions for you. We just have questions which come up organically, depending on the vibe we feel from you. Because we've actually asked questions of you, which we hadn't pre-thought of, but obviously you, I guess, instigated those questions in us. And I prefer that format. I feel it's a lot more natural. If you really want to know a guest, you don't ask them the same question they've been asked 400 times prior. You let them speak and let them go where they want to go with it. But I think that's really been the beauty of it, just being able to let the guests be themselves rather than always being this kind of almost like sock puppet where we want you to say this today, promote this, and give this, you know, narrative.
Canned answer.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Now, do you already have kind of like scripts and guests and everything
We're not really going to have guests to start. We do have scripts. I mean, we want to talk about all the things that I think about. Basically, fake people, liars, frauds, relationships, sex, love, like all the things that are basically, it's going to be a audio version of the visuals that I create. That's what it's going to be. It's very clear to me. I know exactly. I'm not going to talk about current issues. I'm not going to talk about time related stuff. I'm going to talk about style and ideas that people have been thinking about for centuries.
Yeah, you talked about arguments there. I think in all forms of media now, polarization has appeared. I think what used to be untouched, say even something like, you know, kids' TV shows, it seems like there's an agenda behind almost everything now. And certainly photography hasn't been immune from this, because there were images, you know, perhaps like 2-3 years ago, right at the border, the Texas border with Mexico, where some photographers took photos and they were actually found out to be staging them. They were trying to make the border agents look extremely violent and all this, like being bombarded with tear gas when it was like one canister about 400 yards away from where everybody was. But the angle the photos were taken and the staging of them, they were put across pretty much every major network. And there was a lot of condemnation towards, you know, the Border Patrol and everything else. And it turned out these photos were fake, but I think only maybe one or two networks even mentioned or retracted, you know, these photos as being set up. Now, with photography being used as a weapon now in promoting these narratives, regardless of what political side you're on, do you see that as kind of offensive to your art, that people are willing to manipulate it?
I'm not a documentary photographer in any way. I create things from my own imagination.
Yeah.
So I don't make photographs. I don't take photographs. I make photographs, excuse me. I don't take photographs. I make photographs. That's always been my thinking. I don't use tragedies to rush to make images of that. I photograph my ideas of the world.
Now, one thing I've got to ask you, David, about that's on your website is the Diamond Dust Project stuff that you're doing, and that you're turning this into NFTs. So NFTs are, you know, something that's kind of hitting the media now, hitting the news. People are starting to find out a little bit about it. I'd like for you to kind of walk us through, number one, how you got the idea for these Diamond Dust NFTs, and kind of splinter into what got you interested in the NFT world.
So originally I made Diamond Dust prints because I had made all these photographs that I had sold out completely. And I had seen a lot of Diamond Dust works on art that wasn't from the artist's original imagination. So they'd get a picture of Marilyn Monroe, a screen print, and they'd add Diamond Dust and they call it their own. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to take my own work and put diamond dust on my own work because I love the effect. It would elevate the work for me to be even more luxurious than the photographs themselves as just another art form for me. And the reason why I got into the NFTs is because I was watching this digital world, just like with the Oculus, and I thought, I'm going to bridge the physical world and the digital world together. So I made these diamond dust NFTs that were gifts with sparkling, it looks like sparkling stuff all around the image itself, all right? It's an effect. And I want it to be a diamond dust NFT to complement the physical, because I wanted to merge the physical with the digital. So for me, I partner with the right people in the physical world, and I partner with the right people in the digital world. It's two different experts, style of people that I had to collaborate with to make it happen. And I just did my first NFT, and we've pretty much sold the whole thing out.
Nice. So. And of course, that kind of goes along with a lot of different things, you know, mixing those two together. That's usually where we get something good. Like, I immediately think of, and this might throw you a curveball, but maybe not because you're a New Yorker. The first time I had a hamburger with peanut butter on it, I thought, there's no way this can be good. Who puts peanut butter on a hamburger? But I was in New York when I actually had it. And I've tried to bring that up to different hamburger joints in Texas. They look at me like I'm crazy. But putting peanut butter on a hamburger, something you wouldn't actually consider, but when you mix it in there, all of a sudden you have something that tastes fantastic.
Yeah, it's like chocolate and peanut butter, you know? So,
or peanut butter and jelly. Or peanut butter and everything. Maybe it's peanut butter. I mean, maybe that's really what it is peanut butter. Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, it's all about adapting to the times and working with the experts in the moment. Very logical.
Yeah. Now, have you ever done any kind of short movie type thing, or is move in images, does that kind of
I have done some videos, and I love doing them, but I just don't really see the placement for them. My why in life is not to be a film director, even though I think I could do it for sure. It's not my, people are far more passionate for that than me. I focus on what I'm good at and being self-aware enough to know what my real passion is. I don't have a passion for making videos. I think I could do it, and I have done it before, but where am I going to place these videos? And I think people are very impatient also to even watch a 30-second video. So I'd rather make an image that you have to look at in a flash. Bam! I'm in the bam business. Bam! As opposed to, can you give me 30 seconds of your time? People are impatient.
Yeah, do you find that certain types of music goes with some of your work? I mean, do you have synergy and perhaps some of your exhibitions where you have specific musical things playing because it helps the interpretation of your work?
I often play music with my photographs on my Instagram stories that I create at David Drebin, D-R-E-B-I-N. But I don't look at my work and think about music in an exhibition, but I do look at my work and think about music as an Instagram story or a reel or a Twitter post for sure.
Yeah, no, that makes sense because you got to have that, you know, audio portion along with that visual, but you go to like an art museum and usually it's quiet and all that good stuff. So the silence part could speak. And of course, you know, we're, I guess, exactly opposite of you because you're in that, like you say, that bam, you know, give me something in that nice little, you know, piece that you can put together. And we do long form. So, I mean, it's completely opposite. And even you were talking about in the podcast that you want to put together, you know, you want those little bam snippets, right? And so kind of tough for us to wrap that around our heads.
Always think about the audience and their attention span. Very, very important. How do you keep people interested? How do you keep the audience interested? You guys can do a 10-hour podcast. Doesn't mean anyone's going to listen to it. I think it's just important to always, I'm always aware of anybody I'm speaking with, their capacity to comprehend the conversation. Always. So.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you have a little bit of a different audience for your work, although there may be some crossover with, you know, the art of, you know, movies, but you don't have as much opportunity to provide imposition and background with your work. It's right in front of your face, and then it's there, whereas with a movie you might read a review, or the main plot is set up and there's character development, but you have to communicate a lot more in a single image or a single setting than a book or a movie does. And so, you know, for you, does that all come at once with you? You're just able to see what the audience is going to see, or do you sometimes have to take a step back and be like, well, I can see that, but I don't know if the audience is going to be able to perceive that?
I'm my own audience. And I'm always thinking about what would happen if I met myself. I'm doing it all for me. I'm the harshest critic of myself. I never feel successful. I always feel like I am impatient with my effort. I'm patient with my results, and I'm relentless in my pursuit. But I am the biggest audience for my work. No one looks at my work more than me.
No, I mean, that's a good part to be in, I guess. And I'm at a loss for the word I want to use, but to be your own harshest critic or whatever and say, you know, if I can't look at this myself, watch this, listen to this, then why would I want to put it out in the world? Versus a lot of stuff, it's let's throw stuff against the wall, see what sticks, see what somebody.
No, I don't think that way.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Did I miss that a little bit? So you don't think
I wonder what sticks. I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, we're agreeing. You know, most people though, in today's day and age, they throw a bunch of stuff to the wall to see what sticks, and, you know, use that shotgun approach where you're more of a rifle shot and you know what that rifle shot's going to hit.
I know when it's good.
Yeah. Always. And it's good that you have that self-confidence, because you always hear this phrase or term, tortured artist, where people go from being self-critical to being self-depreciating. And there is a difference there between, you know, wanting to do the best you know you can do and maybe even on occasion surpass it, and telling yourself you're a piece of crap and your work is terrible. And, you know, sometimes people slide into that line when they're too self-critical. But I mean, it's good that you're confident in yourself, that you know that, well, basically you're confident that your audience can see what you see, because like you said, you are the audience. Now, with all that being said, have you ever looked at any iconic images? You know, there's lots of famous photos ranging from, you know, maybe Marilyn Monroe and the wind blowing up her skirt to, you know, wartime photos. Have you ever looked at any iconic photos and thought, that's a really poorly taken photo? It was just opportunist that was the closest person with a camera, but that really didn't convey. Perhaps if I was there, I would have perhaps taken it a little bit differently.
Never thought of that. No. I've looked at the greatest photographs of all time and thought, wow, those are great photographs. I never thought, I wonder if I can make it better. No, they made it great. I appreciate greatness. I make my work, they make their work, and there's abundance for everybody.
Couldn't that be also aligned with overinterpretation of art? And I always think about this in books, where there's the old joke that the author of the book said the house had a red door. And by the time it gets to school, the teacher is saying, well, the door being red symbolizes this and blah, blah, blah. And if you could have actually asked the author's like, no, I just wanted the door to be red. That was it.
I'm not into over-intellectualizing art. I'm just like straight to the point, like yes or no.
Right.
And see, for me, it's all yes or no. Yes, it's great. No, it's shit.
Yeah. Do you think the art that, I guess, the artists say, oh, it's supposed to make you think, is sometimes taking a bit of a cheap way out of, they're perhaps not sure about the work they created themselves? Because like you say, you see that image before you ever create it. But, you know, that kind of excuse of, oh, this is supposed to make you think, makes them think like, well, I took this, it kind of looked good, and I hope other people can see the meaning of it, because I'm not entirely sure, you know, what I've created here.
I think it's confidence is everything and belief in yourself is everything. I think when you start thinking what other people are thinking, you're in a lot of trouble. I think what I think. I think a lot of people think about what other people think before they think. And I think about what I think before I think. So hope you guys enjoyed chatting with me.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. And kind of a nice little illusion there. please, and you did mention your Instagram and all that, but can you go ahead and kind of go over all the ways people can not only find you, but find your artwork and all that sure. on the internet and all that good stuff?
So on Instagram, I'm at David Drevin, D-R-E-B-I-N. On Twitter, I'm at daviddrevin.eth, E-T-H. And on the web, I'm just daviddrevin.com, D-R-E-B-I-N. And the passion comes from within and it's burning nonstop.
I love it. Well, hey, David, thanks for taking some time out of your day to talk to us. We certainly appreciate it. And that will do it for this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. And we will catch you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.